This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Fred Bever, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Eleven Republican presidential hopefuls filed across a Manchester stage last night, joined by three on a screen coming from D.C., in a forum that marked their first joint appearance in the 2016 race. Some, such as Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, took it as a chance to introduce himself.
I'm a new, fresh face versus a name from the past. I'm someone from outside of Washington with a proven track record, and most of all, I've gotten things done in a blue state.
And for others who've maybe made a bit more of a personal investment in the state, you know, so far, it was kind of a reintroduction. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie joked that he hoped voters are glad that he's still here.
Yeah, I'm like the bad relative you invite for Thanksgiving, you know?
It's The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. As we and you dissect last night's Republican forum, let us hear from you. Call in. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us in the studio today are Dante Scali. He's a political science professor at UNH, and NHPR's own senior political reporter, Josh Rogers. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And coming to us from the U.S. Capitol, senior editor and correspondent for NPR News, Ron Elving. Thanks for joining, Ron.
Good to be with you, Fred.
Okay, you sound nice and clear there. Now, among us all, Josh drew the honor of covering last night's forum in person at St. Anselm College. 2 hours, Josh, 14 candidates, three of them still in D.C. Set the scene. Was it unwieldy?
Well, just sitting there when they were calling the roll, it was one of these things we were almost looking at your watch waiting to see when the procession ended. You know, it was. It's tough to have that many candidates in a forum. You know, it had an elevator pitch, sort of speed dating feel to it at times, where candidates were getting up on stage, they were coming back, they were reintroduced. The room wasn't filled; it was largely filled with Republican elders on the bottom tier. Lots of students up top, but some empty seats. You know, wasn't a thrilling event, but informative.
Not a lot of applause, but people were paying attention.
No, I mean, they were instructed not to. But it was you know, a lot of this stuff was kind of stump speech, jukebox kind of thing, where we hit a topic. Here's my talking point. It's hard to get around that in candidate forums in general, particularly when you have to move so quickly.
To me, at one point, it reminded me of an audition for maybe a high school musical, and each candidate would come up and say, "Now I'll sing for you When I Was Governor." There were a lot sort of these repetitive points because, you know, all of these former governors or current governors are saying, "What, you know, I balanced the budget, I cut state employment roles." Were there points where people really sort of woke up?
Well, I mean, I think the discussion, the first question out of the box from the moderator, Jack Heath, and these questions were purportedly informed by the wishes of voters in the three early states that there were broadcasting this debate, was immigration. And that has become a really central issue in this Republican primary, as it has been, you know, in the past Republican primary. But it was interesting to hear the candidates on that. One thing you're not hearing this time is really any talk about so-called path to citizenship. There seems to be broad agreement that the first thing you need to do is, you know, fix the border.
And I want to get back to the immigration question because that did really dominate the first part of the event last night in a minute. But Dante Scala of UNH, I want to ask you, for the New Hampshire audience, because this event had two audiences, a national audience on C-SPAN, but very much the New Hampshire audience. And what were the stakes here for these candidates? What did they need to do?
For a lot of viewers last night, it was a chance to see the candidates for the first time. And that sounds strange, perhaps, because the candidates have been visiting and so forth. But there are an awful lot of voters in New Hampshire. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of people. And so a good number of them probably tuned in to, say, WMUR last night expecting to see an entertainment show and instead got a couple of hours worth of a voters forum. So voters are just – voters and elites in this process are on two different tracks. By this time, elites have heard the stump speeches, and if they tuned in, they were hearing some recycling going on. But for voters, it was a chance to see the candidates for the first time, and it was a chance for candidates to make a good first positive impression on those little more casual voters, but still people who intend to vote next winter.
And when you say elites, you mean party elders, operatives, pollsters,
donors.
Media, donors.
Right, absolutely.
Now, Ron Elving, from a national perspective, what were these candidates up to? Was this really kind of a preview for the debate that's going to take place on Thursday in Cleveland on Fox television?
For some of them, it was a preview, but that would be those we know are going to be in that debate. For several of them, this was the last-ditch effort to get into the debate on Thursday night because, let's say, three of the candidates who were out there last night were on the bubble, waiting to see whether or not they're going to be in the top 10 in whatever polls Fox News decides it's going to look at. Now, of course, Fox is going to look at its own poll, and it's going to look at a few others that are considered to be the most reputable polls, we believe. And sometime this evening, they're going to let us know who those last few people are going to be. So I'm talking here particularly about John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who has entered the race quite late. He was the 16th candidate out of 17, and he was the latest to enter of those who appeared last night in New Hampshire. But he appears to be just getting in over the bar, and he did, I thought, have a great performance last night. Insofar as you can have one in that format, he seemed to be able to get across a couple of times that he had been budget chairman back when the House Republicans were able, with Bill Clinton and a Republican Senate, to, in theory at least, balance the federal budget back in the 1990s leading up to the year 2000. So that's a great point to leave people with. He seems to have gotten just enough percentage now. He's at 3.6 in the national polls done by Fox News itself. And the last person then he's competing with would appear to be Chris Christie. And the loser in all of that would appear to be Rick Perry, who might just be dropping to number 11. And that means he's going to be at the kiddie table. I'm sorry, that's what everyone's calling it, at 5 o'clock on Thursday. The guys who didn't make it into the actual debate.
Into a secondary debate. Governor Kasich also made a very interesting sort of wake up the ears kind of comment that kind of harkened back to an idea of compassionate conservatism. And I think we have that part of that comment that he made sort of late in the show.
Well, I'm not here to criticize my party, but what I will tell you is I think that economic growth is not just an end unto itself. I think it's very important that with economic growth comes responsibility and ability to help people who live in the shadows.
Now, this was a comment that was sort of echoed also by Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, who was talking about compassion for people with heroin addiction, saying everybody's made mistakes. Is this emerging as an important theme for some of the contenders? Ron Elving, maybe I'll start with you, to show that they can have this kind of conservatism, even as they call for budget cuts and for reduced taxes.
Yes, I think particularly the governors are going to try to go there. I think they're going to try to show that because they've had to administer programs that were there in their states already, and this would apply also to Scott Walker in Wisconsin, because they've had to be responsible for a lot of those kinds of programs, they more or less might as well take it as a credit because people are probably going to attack them for the money that it involves. And if you can show a little compassion, if you can show that you're also in favor of prison reform and criminal justice reform, that's part of what Chris Christie is talking about, that shows that you have another dimension besides tight budgets. And of course, all of them talk about balancing their budget and low taxes. And of course, all of them want to talk about that as well. It's just showing another dimension and harking back to what's been successful for some other Republican presidential candidates in the past.
Dante Scala, does it play in New Hampshire?
Yeah, people expect John Kasich to play a role that John McCain did in 2000 and that John Huntsman tried to play in 2012. Which is this kind of right-of-center Republican who's moderate on some issues, bucks party orthodoxy on some issues. And for Kasich, it's, among other things, it's accepting Medicaid expansion as governor of Ohio. And so Kasich is walking a bit of a tightrope, and he was walking it last night when he said, on the one hand, I'm not up here to criticize members of my party, because Republican primary voters, understandably, aren't real interested in candidates who criticize the Republican Party outright. But yet Kasich seems to be trying to nudge the party along and say, I want to bring something else to the table that the other candidates are not. And so that's what I think we're going to be watching from Kasich and also from Chris Christie over the next several months.
Josh, did you get a sense of how the room responded to those kinds of comments from some of the governors like Christie and Kasich?
Well, from Christie and Kasich, I mean, Christie has talked a great deal about drugs while campaigning up here, policies in New Jersey. Last night he said, you know, the war on drugs was a failure, well-intentioned but a failure. And he's talked about steps that have been taken in New Jersey. He's campaigned at a drug rehabilitation facility in New Hampshire. So that's not really new from him. And on the compassionate conservative front, that's not really new for John Kasich either. That was something George W. Bush kind of took that mantle when Kasich briefly ran before. I also think it's hard to read too much into these things, but embedded in Kasich's remarks about, you know, the party needs to be more about growth in and of itself, that, you know, you could also take that as a somewhat veiled criticism of what Jeb Bush said last night, which was when he was asked why he got in this race, he immediately launched into his talking point of to make sure the economy grows at 4%, which might be a tall order, but I think Kasich was also going at Jeb Bush a little last night. And, you know, if he's going to gain more traction, the thinking among many is it's going to have to be, you know, people who pull voters from Jeb Bush.
So now the big issue sort of on the other side, where there's more of a get tough quality that we heard in the conversation last night, was on immigration, which was one of the issues that the people who responded to the request from the newspapers involved asked be addressed. And we heard sort of varying degrees of toughness on border control and that sort of thing. Just before we go to the break, I think if we could hear from Rick Santorum, who really had the toughest stance on the issue of immigration.
I'm the only person in this race that has called for not just securing the border, following up on the visas, imposing E-Verify, but calling for a 25% reduction in the unskilled labor that's coming into this country. It is a serious problem. Everyone else is dancing around it.
So there was a lot of dancing around it, whether they were engaging or disengaging. Why is immigration on the top of the list at a forum in New Hampshire?
Well, for one, it's an issue because Donald Trump says it's an issue. And that was one of the catalysts for Donald Trump to rise to the top right now is his comments on immigration. And what we're seeing from all the candidates, really, and it's an interesting split. For Rick Santorum, he sees immigration as yet another threat to white working class voters who have seen their income stagnate for years and years now. And so you hear varying levels of degrees about what to do about immigration and guest workers.
And we'll come right back to that when we return to The Exchange. We'll delve farther into the GOP forum. Stay with us for more of The Exchange on NHPR. And this is The Exchange. I'm Fred Bever, in for Laura Kanoy. We're looking at the GOP's Manchester face-off last night. Do you think the presidential winnowing is beginning, at least on the GOP side? Where are New Hampshire voters headed? Tell us what you think by calling 1-800-892-6477, or you can email exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm here in the studio with Dante Scala, political science professor at UNH, and Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. And by phone, we have senior Washington editor for NPR News, Ron Elving. So we were starting to get into the immigration debate that was front and center at the forum last night. What do any of you gentlemen see going on here? Anything new, any notable points about the way these candidates tried to define themselves in opposition to each other, in opposition to any of the Democratic contenders? What were the learning takeaways on this?
Well, I mean, it's clear that candidates, even who have made immigration reform, key parts of their political agenda, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Rick Perry's position has stiffened a little bit since the last time he ran. I mean, there's the main thrust now is simply we've got to secure the border first. Candidates like Rubio and Bush talk about reforming the legal immigration system, as did Rick Santorum, but they take in a slightly different direction. They seem to say what we need to do is modernize the standard for bringing people in, make it less based on blood relation and more based on merit. Both Rubio and Bush have talked about being a little bit more like Canada in that respect, bringing in people who can help the economy grow. You know, Santorum's position was one, you know, those folks would be a threat to the workers and voters. You know, he says the country needs to protect, but there's very little talk about anything resembling a path to citizenship. As far as anyone goes, maybe a legal status in time.
Ron Elving, Marco Rubio seems to be going through something of an evolution in the way he approaches this issue, and he had this formulation about things that need to happen first. Have you heard that before? Is he sort of giving himself a guarded way to make an appeal to the Hispanic voters?
Yes. In a word, yes. That's what he's trying to do, and it is an evolution. You've used the right word there, too. I think that he has run against a brick wall in his party, not just in this presidential pursuit of his, but as a senator in 2013, when there was a bipartisan movement involving some of the other presidential candidates as well, Lindsey Graham in particular, to put together a bipartisan group that could put together a bill that could comprehensively overhaul the immigration laws of the United States. Very ambitious effort, and they got the 60 votes that it took, more than 60, to get that through the procedural hurdles of the Senate and actually pass it. But, of course, it got to the House and stopped dead. The House was not going to consider it. The House did not want to talk about anything beyond enforcement at the border, and so that's where things have remained since then. Marco Rubio, running for president, would like to be championing that kind of a comprehensive agreement. But what we heard from him last night was this three-part deal that begins with securing the border, with all the talk about the fence, with all the talk about enforcement, and then moved on to eventually talking about green cards for people after many, many years, as he put it, and many, many hurdles for them. It was light years from where he was in 2013 and where he might be in his heart. But he can read the tea leaves. He can read what is going on in the Republican Party.
And Dante, what is going on in the Republican Party in New Hampshire? How important is the immigration issue on the ground here and in the New Hampshire primary?
I mean, I think that you can bet at virtually every town hall meeting of a candidate that there's a good likelihood that they're going to get a question on immigration. But here again, I think there's this division in the New Hampshire Republican Party that you saw play out on the stage last night, is that there's disagreement among, say, people in the business community who would like to see immigration reform, a comprehensive package like Marco Rubio proposed, like John McCain proposed in the last decade, versus it's the elites versus more of the base who hear what Donald Trump had to say and say, look, the failure to build a fence is a failure, again, of Washington, D.C., including Republican elites, and a failure of the people we've elected to get the job done that we wanted them to do. They talk a big game, but they don't get things done.
And so any of you, is this part of what was going on here is, you know, being responsive to a more Tea Party side of the primary electorate as opposed to the more moderate side? In the way these gentlemen were positioning themselves on any of the issues.
That's certainly what I was implying when I said tea leaves. It is certainly the influence of the Tea Party. It is certainly the influence of Donald Trump, who was the missing elephant, who was nonetheless the elephant in the room last night. And he has made this so front and center that Republicans who were hoping that in a field with a couple of people who grew up in a Spanish-speaking home, Marco Rubio and, of course, Ted Cruz, and also Jeb Bush, who has a Spanish-speaking wife and who does a pretty good job of speaking Spanish himself for a gringo, that would be a new face for the party with the Hispanic voters. Instead, the face of the party at the moment, and let's be sure we say that, at the moment, is Donald Trump and his villainizing of everyone who comes from Mexico. Now, that's not to say that he doesn't stop and say, oh, some of them I'm sure are good people. But I think we can all hear that message too.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump a little bit. His name wasn't even mentioned at the forum last night. Ron Elving, what was his calculation in not joining this forum? Is he blowing off New Hampshire, or is it smarter than that?
Perhaps a bit smarter than that. He certainly will not blow off New Hampshire. He will be in New Hampshire. He will bid for New Hampshire. He is working hard on New Hampshire. But his thought was, this is not really New Hampshire. This is a forum for C-SPAN, for that audience, for people who want to get a better national polling number. I've already got a wonderful national polling number. I'm leading everybody. I'm in the 20s. Nobody else is, even into the high teens. He could say all of those things. Plus, it just wasn't a format that allows him to be the Donald. Now, I'm not sure that the Thursday night Fox format is going to do so either. 60-second answers, 30-second answers, that's not his wheelhouse. But he certainly didn't want to be part of this, as you called it earlier, speed dating, which it clearly was. People practically trotting across the stage, taking a brief perch on that high stool, and then someone would come and lead them up. Please come off the stage, Governor. I mean, it was demeaning for the candidates. I don't know that that format is going to be agreed to again by any of them sitting in the front row as though they were, you know, local councilman candidates, as someone has already said. Just truly demeaning for all of them, and Donald Trump didn't want any part of it.
New Hampshire wanted to see him here today, don't they?
You bet.
Wanted to see Trump?
Yeah.
I'm sure they would have liked to see him. You know, the thing about debates, though, as one of my colleagues pointed out from the monkey cage at the Washington Post, that debates and forums have this leveling effect. And I think Ron's right about that. I'm not sure if it was demeaning necessarily, but it would have put Trump as just another candidate. And that'll be interesting to watch in the debate on Thursday, how Trump reacts to one being the front runner, which is a very different position than being the voice of outrage. And then two, just being another candidate behind a podium, just one of 10, that's going to be a different sort of situation for him.
We do have a listener who wrote in via email, Ben in Hudson. He says, do you think any candidates actually answered the questions they were asked, and did it help or hurt them? How did you think the candidates came off to a New Hampshire audience? Now, this puts us in mind of a moment when candidate Carly Fiorina, one of the few non-office holders to be on the stage tonight, was asked about the least popular decision you have ever made. And I think host Jack Heath may have been thinking about having to lay people off or fire them when she was at Hewlett-Packard. She didn't quite answer it, but let's hear what her answer was.
We talk a lot at election time, but somehow we never solve these festering problems. It's because the status quo is in charge. Leaders challenge the status quo.
And I wanted to use that quote because there were several comments last night to the effect of, Senator Cruz, who refers to the Washington cartel. Fiorina made several comments about the status quo and being against the status quo, the Washington. I don't think she used the word cabal, but the idea that that the establishment, and I think you might want to read Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton together under that, have been in charge of things too long, and this goes again, I think, to the Tea Party influence, perhaps. Is Fiorina, is Rick Cruz, are they trying to really grab up a segment of the Republican Party? You even had Donald Trump.
Rand Paul is running against the so-called Washington machine.
Josh,
I mean,
Rogers.
You know, obviously, running against Washington is not uncommon. And you look at the way people stand in the polls, including Ben Carson. It seems like there's always sort of an anti-Washington mood, but based on the polls, it's clear that a lot of people who are likely to vote in the Republican primary are sick of and disappointed by the people who are in there. And so, it's not surprising. One thing that's also interesting, though, is to listen to how the various candidates cast themselves as new. Rand Paul will say, I'm a different kind of Republican, and that he means on a policy level. Walker, I'm a new fresh face. Rubio trotted through a portion of his remarks, mentioning the generational shifts that have taken place and, sort of casting himself as a candidate for the age of Uber and, online retailing. you know, the Republican electorate, though, is old. And so it is it's interesting to watch. But there is an anti-Washington mood when you go out to these events. It certainly has helped Donald Trump. You talk to people. There are a lot of angry folks showing up at these events.
Dante Scala.
Yeah, I mean, to the caller's question, I think there were – I think some candidates did address questions fairly directly. I think if a voter sat through part or all of the forum, they knew more about the candidates when they turned it off than when they started. I think there were different – certainly degrees, and some candidates decided to fall back on their stump speeches and to give the same answers. And you could tell the differences between, say, a Scott Walker – who would repeat the same themes of growth and reform to, say, more of a neophyte like Dr. Ben Carson, who would get questions that were really teed up for him to give a very conservative answer, where he didn't take advantage the way – and he wandered a bit. And it just made the difference between someone who's run for office so many times like Scott Walker versus a Ben Carson who's out there for the first time.
I can say nothing of the question that Rick Perry, the question about the three federal agencies, the federal departments you would eliminate. And he was one of the lighter moments of the night where he said, I recall that question. He didn't specify which ones he would eliminate. But I think you know, they answer the questions as much as candidates ever do.
Scott Walker, he took a slight dodge. He was asked if climate change was caused by human action. He fell back on saying, well, as an Eagle Scout, I learned, you know, try to leave the place cleaner than when you came in. I wasn't quite sure why he needed to not make a statement on that. What's the danger? It's Ron Elving for Scott Walker in saying climate change is or is not caused by human activity.
Let's assume first there's no danger in saying he was a Boy Scout. And let's also assume that he's not really proposing that the human race leave the planet cleaner than we found it when we came in. It really strikes me as a total dodge. He has changed his position on this, as he has on a few other issues, to make sure that he is not allowing there to be much space between him and the people he's counting on in these primaries and caucuses, beginning with Iowa. And the Iowa caucuses are the place he has to win. He has to break through there. And he's leading there, and he's just about the one guy who's got something he can really hang on to and say, this is mine. So he wants to make sure that he doesn't start talking like some kind of a moderate or, in some sense or another, embracing the president's climate change program that the president announced yesterday. So he said that would cost Wisconsin too much money, and he was against it.
We're getting a few emails in. I also want to remind listeners that they can call into the exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. I was also wondering if both Scott Walker and Jeb Bush, who are sort of right, or I wouldn't say right behind Donald Trump in the polls right now, but they're the next in line, they seemed a little more careful than other candidates on the stage tonight. Did you folks get that impression?
I mean, Scott Walker in particular seemed to have a few talking points that he wanted to stick close to, and that it was clear he had a few themes that he wanted to hammer home. Jeb Bush seemed to offer more detail, I thought, although sometimes he got a little bit, I think, lost in all the details. But both of them, again, would be in the front right now if not for Donald Trump. So you can imagine why they might have a little more caution versus, say, someone like a Lindsey Graham, who's, you know, this older senator, friend of John McCain, who's trying to recreate the magic of 2000. He would get up there and say, I think we can still get a bipartisan deal on immigration reform, which sounded good when John McCain said it a decade ago, but now sounds vaguely heretical to the Republican Party of 2016.
Well, let's hear what Jeb Bush had to say on Common Core, because that's sort of a flashpoint here in New Hampshire. And I wasn't sure quite what to make of how he answered that question. And I'd like to hear what you guys think about that.
Governor Bush, Common Core curriculum has been controversial here in New Hampshire. Standards remain controversial. Should state and local school boards reject any so-called national educational standards?
They should. They should. States ought to create standards. They should be high. They should be state-driven and locally implemented. The federal government should have no role in the creation of standards, no role in the creation, indirectly or directly, in the creation of content and curriculum. The federal government's role in education ought to be to provide support for states that want reform.
What's he up to there? Josh.
Well, I mean, one thing that's interesting is obviously Common Core is a issue that among Republicans' electorate is an unpopular policy. You know, there's some confusion among a lot of these voters about what it actually is and does. But putting that aside, the first visit Jeb Bush made to New Hampshire, he was asked about this immediately. One of the first things he said is, like, I'm all in on Common Core. And you certainly didn't get that last night.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, to Dante's point, you know, people like Bush and Walker who are at the higher end of the polls, I mean, there is kind of the first rule of these sorts of things is do yourself no harm. And I think that that was one thing that Jeb Bush was out to achieve. I don't think it was his smoothest performance. I mean, he hasn't he'd been doing a pretty good job on the campaign trail. It's unclear at this point whether forums and debates are really going to be where he's at his best. But he did offer some detail on a lot of policies. This was one where he obviously was trying to, you know, he didn't want to embrace Common Core to the extent he has on the campaign trail up here.
Dante.
Yeah, a lot. It's difficult for voters because these candidates all take more or less the same positions on a variety of issues. So you really have to listen carefully, I think, to get the different shades of red that come out from these sorts of forums. And so you find, like, say, a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio, who are still in favor of immigration reform, you know, shading their answers a bit and making – punching up certain parts of the answer, like border security and E-Verify, and downplaying the immigration reform parts. Well, eventually we'll get to the point where people, illegal immigrants, will get green cards and then perhaps a path to citizenship. It's still there, but it's covered up a bit.
Ron Elving, do you think that the question of Common Core, is that a flashpoint in some of the other early states? Are the candidates going to have to contend with that?
Yes, no question. And Jeb Bush is characterizing Common Core in a way that is almost a caricature. It's not really – he's not describing the Common Core that he supports. He's describing the Common Core that people don't like, as though it were all coming out of Barack Obama's imagination, as though it were all coming from Washington, D.C., and it was some sort of federal mandate being pressed down on the brow of the states. That is not what it is. Jeb Bush knows that. He was involved in developing Common Core when he was a governor. He has always been a supporter of it. Some of these other candidates have been in the past supporters of it but have backed off from it. This is something that has gotten largely ambushed out there on the hustings, and as a result, the candidates have to deal with that caricature as opposed to the reality of what Common Core actually was.
It was interesting. None of the candidates were really able to ambush each other on such issues today. When we come back, we'll look at what's ahead in presidential politics in New Hampshire and beyond, maybe even get a glimpse at developments on the Democratic side of the column. Stay with us for more on The Exchange. And this is The Exchange here on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. We're talking about last night's GOP forum. We just got a call, an email from a listener who asked this question. I listened to the forum in its entirety, and I was disappointed in the amount of fear-mongering immigrants are out there to get us. Iran is preparing to drop a nuclear bomb. ISIS is coming to get us. These things will most likely not happen, and more mundane things have a higher probability of harming us. Climate change, debt, the defense budget. Why are these more mundane things not addressed? And this is from Andy. And the question I want to sort of bring that into is take a look at some of the very strong rhetoric that was used. For instance, from Senator Ted Cruz, when talking about the potential Iran deal that President Obama has proposed. I'm hoping we can get that up. Senator Ted Cruz was talking about the Iran deal from President Obama.
Roughly $100 billion, over $100 billion, will flow into Iran. Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. That money, in turn, billions of it, will go on to Hamas, to Hezbollah, to the Houthis. You know, it's very interesting. I pointed out a couple of weeks ago that if this deal goes through, that the Obama administration will become the world's leading global financier of radical Islamic terrorism.
Ron Elving, what do you make of that kind of rhetoric? Does that go far? Does the electorate think, wow, we're getting in the business of funding terrorism?
Ted Cruz will have his followers, and there will be those he persuades that that is exactly what the United States is doing, and that we should elect Ted Cruz to save us all, or to save the world. The the idea of saying that the Obama administration is going to be the world's largest sponsor of Islamic terrorism, I think can stand or fall on its own merits. I don't think very many people are going to adapt that attitude, but it does get Ted Cruz's attention. And Ted has the problem that Rand Paul has and Marco Rubio has and Lindsey Graham has. These four Republican senators running for president are having a terrible time breaking through. They're being superseded by the governors in the race. They're being superseded, of course, by the Donald. And so they feel they have to do things to get attention. Another candidate who was not on the stage last night, Mike Huckabee, has gotten attention for comparing the Iran deal to the Holocaust. That is a method. And if you are worried about being stuck at 5 or 6%, as these candidates all are, and if you're worried that suddenly you're going to drop out of the debate top 10, or if you're going to stop being taken seriously by donors, and Ted Cruz is doing very well with donors, by the way, if you're worried about any of those things, one way to keep your name in the news and to make sure that you're reaching out to the people who care the very most is to make statements of that kind.
And so our listener's question is, what about the mundane things? I think, you know, when it's, you got to stand out, you got to make these statements, Dante.
Yeah, I think. Well, there's a lot more diversity among the Republican candidates on domestic policy than there is in foreign policy. On domestic policy, the candidates will talk about medical marijuana, for example. John Kasich's in favor of Medicaid expansion, or at least he signed off on it. Common Core, immigration reform. There are arguments going on the Republican side. But on foreign policy, seems there might be some nuances on foreign policy. But to a man and to a woman, very against the Iran deal, for instance. To a man, to a woman, very against how President Obama has handled Russia, for example. So there's a lot more uniformity on that side of things, on the foreign policy side, than there is on the domestic side, where you can find some more disagreements.
Now, I'd like to go to the phones now. We've got a couple of calls in, and if we can, we'll bring up Dan from Nashua. Jan, please join the conversation.
Thanks very much. I wanted to point out one big difference in this primary from past cycles. There were some mind-blowing numbers over the weekend reported in the New York Times that I think 130 individuals or families are responsible for most of the money funding the Republican candidates, and quite a bit of concentration of funders on the Democratic side, too. And I was struck by the comment that Governor Walker made in refusing to answer the question, is climate change related to human activity? That may be partly pandering to Republican-based voters, but we know that's also a position strongly held by some of his major financial backers. That climate change is not or shouldn't be addressed by the government or just doesn't exist. And this is an issue which the candidates have been taking a lot of questions on the trail. I think there was one question to Governor Jindal last night. Would he do anything about money in politics? And some mention from Carly Fiorina about pushing back against crony capitalism, for example. And I just wonder if you see this issue playing out more, especially with the fact that for the first time in the sort of super PACs have really come of age, and we're seeing a tremendous concentration of money from just a handful of very wealthy families and companies in America.
I believe Jindal gave the sort of sunlight is the best disinfectant kind of answer. Do any of you guys see that actually money in politics could become a Republican issue? Democrats have been beating up on the Republicans over the Koch brothers. This week, Donald Trump, even though his campaign manager was a former worker for the Koch brothers, he called these guys who were going to visit the Koch brothers puppets. So is this actually an issue that could become a cudgel, that could start playing in the Republican side?
Well, I do think that's part of the appeal of Donald Trump, is that he gets up in front of people and says, I'm my own man. I'm not a creature of Republican donors. I don't kowtow to these people. And I think that is part of what's going on with Trump in terms of his appeal to base voters as opposed to Republican elites. Now, I don't expect Donald Trump to come out in favor of campaign finance reform a la Bernie Sanders or Ben and Jerry. But I think it is playing out in the Republican field in that way, that Trump is seen as his own person, as a truly anti-establishment, whereas all these other candidates are vying for these very well-heeled donors.
Ron Elving, is this something that actually the forces which would like to see campaign finance reform, would like to undo some of the effects of the Supreme Court's decision that created the super PACs, do they see an opening? You know, the advocates in D.C., do they see an opening to get this into more of the conversation on the Republican side?
Without speaking for them, my surmise would be that they would see in this election primarily an opportunity for the money to get so big, for the numbers to be so enormous, that the culture, the political culture, will begin to be revulsed by it. In the past, when we have had campaign finance reform in the back to the turn of the 1900s and then in the 1970s and very briefly in the early years of the George W. Bush administration, each time it followed a scandal. Each time it followed the realization of how much corruption was following on some of these enormous financial involvements and investments in candidates. And that can happen again. That might happen again. I think we're already seeing it, as we've heard, with Donald Trump being his own man, that kind of routine. I don't have to raise money. I'm a billionaire. I'm very rich. So that's true. He can do that. And that is part of his appeal, I think, on the Republican side. There's no one who can do quite that on the Democratic side, or at least no one running yet, although there's always that possibility.
And so I'm wondering also just about the tone, what we learned about these guys, seeing them right next to each other. Was there a standout? Was there a quality of character that made people stand out? None of them really went after each other. And actually, no one even went after Hillary Clinton until Lindsey Graham brought that up, and he sort of brought a new tone into the conversation last night, and I think we can hear now what Lindsey Graham had to say about the Clintons.
As to the Clintons, I've been dealing with this crowd for 20 years. I'm fluent in Clinton speak. You want me to translate, Jack? When he says, Bill says, I didn't have sex with that woman, he did. When she says, I'll tell you about building the pipeline when I get to be president, means she won't. And when she tells us, trust me, you've got all the emails that you need, we haven't even scratched the surface. So I understand this crowd, and I can beat them. And if we can't beat them, it doesn't matter.
Ron Elving said earlier that Graham's really struggling to get his profile up in the poll against some of these other guys. Josh Rogers, how did he do last night?
Well, I mean, I think he seemed to enjoy himself on stage and was sort of, you know, kind of letting it all hang out. You know, the other, I mean, as far as going after Secretary Clinton, you know, Fiorina and Bobby Jindal also did. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, it has some correlation to where they stand in the polls and trying to get attention. But, you know, there's been no shortage of criticism of you know, Hillary Clinton throughout this process. We're going to get a heck of a lot more. I mean, one thing interesting about Carly Fiorina is that she, you know, as another woman, has a bit more liberty to really go after Hillary Clinton in a way a male candidate probably couldn't. She was always like, you know, we need somebody who's going to throw every punch. She often boils it down to said, we need somebody who will fight her. You know, it would be tough for male candidates to be so tough, but they were the three that talked about her the most.
Dante.
You know, I thought Rand Paul offered a more distinctive message than most last night. He was one of the ones who had to go come in via satellite mm-hmm. from Washington, D.C. because of the Senate vote. But, for instance, he was asked what the first foreign country that he would visit as president. And he said China or Russia, that the president should go to see not a friend necessarily but an opponent. And he went on in that vein and talked about how his message, a liberty message, would reach out to new voters who weren't typical Republicans. And I thought he did a good job of presenting he's been having trouble finding his way, I think, in this large Republican field and how to mainstream his message. He seemed very comfortable in his own shoes last night.
Well, and Marco Rubio made an interesting pitch to younger voters and to new voters as well when he name-checked Amazon and other Uber and the companies which are now The biggest companies in what were formerly sort of bricks and mortar places are now online and virtual. Is there some benefit for him that could potentially help him out? Dante, you're nodding your head.
I mean, it was a real contrast between Rubio's message talking about how Amazon is this huge enterprise without a single storefront versus, say, someone like a Rick Santorum or a Rick Perry, who seemed to be hearkening back to the days
when manufacturing back.
That it could employ lots of people. And I think Marco Rubio, if he's got an ace card to play, is going to be, I'm a new candidate who realizes the new realities of 21st century America, especially in the economic area. And the bygone days are bygone.
And he also he pitched it as sort of like people are scared, they're anxious, they're worried. And it's all because of all this change in the world. I thought it was an interesting way to look at the fears about ISIS or the fears about economic insecurity. Ron Elving, is that something that voters nationally can respond to?
Possibly, and certainly younger voters to whom he is appealing. But when people are really worried, when they're really anxious, do they turn to an absolutely fresh face, the youngest candidate in the field? Or when they're really concerned and anxious, are they more likely to look for someone who's a little bit more reassuring? Or possibly they'd look for a combination of both. The difference between Marco Rubio, perhaps, and Amazon, Uber, and Airbnb is that each of those three phenomena came up with a really neat idea for doing something basic lots better than anybody else had ever done it using the Internet. We're still waiting to see if that's true of Marco Rubio.
Yeah, what's his paradigm shift?
Well, a fresh face is not necessarily enough. There are lots of fresh faces.
Dante, you think that the youth can play?
Well, it has once, right? I mean, we saw this in 2008 when American voters went with someone very untested in terms of political experience to become president. So I think Marco Rubio is hoping that, you know, lightning can strike twice, or lightning can strike on his side, and that he can present this contrast to more established candidates.
So I'd like to go back to the phones now, if we can, and get one more caller in before we wrap up the show. We've got Matt in Concord. Matt, thanks for waiting, and please join us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on. Like I told the screener, I wasn't sure this is a great question, but with so many candidates, why doesn't the Republican Party sort of unite and set forth the best candidates? And why aren't they talking? I don't understand why so many candidates, why convolute the field? Let's find some front runners and the other 10, support those people. Is that an off-the-wall question? Does that make any sense?
Well, it's
you're far too modest, Matt. I mean, that's a question that was certainly on the minds of Republican leaders when they tried to set up a debate schedule that would shorten the runway on that they believe hurt Mitt Romney last time when you had Republicans duking it out for so long. I mean, the situation that they devised may not achieve that. It seems like it isn't, but. You know, it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing. But there, you know, it's the Republican world is restive. I mean, there is no next in line, which has traditionally been the way things have operated this cycle, and that's one reason why so many candidates are in this.
Dante.
And typically in the past, Republican elites would join together and support candidates through money. And when contributions were capped at $2,000 or $3,000, it was easy for a Mitt Romney, say, to outshine a Rick Santorum or a Newt Gingrich. But what we started to see last cycle and that we're seeing now, it doesn't take thousands of donors to support a candidate. It takes a few very wealthy donors to back a candidate. So it could be the case that more candidates will persist for longer because they don't need thousands of donors. They need several
benefactors.
Benefactors, exactly.
And right. Any number can play as long as they're all billionaires.
Well, and this is why Donald Trump is in this unique position. But Ron Elving, there is an establishment candidate here. Is it not Jeb Bush? Is there reason to believe that if you were going to make a bet, wouldn't he be the one you'd bet on?
This is still where I believe the smart money is going, and that's why he has raised well over $100 million dollars so far and can do the same in the next so many months and in the next so many months after that. He has ongoing fundraising ability, and more of the top 250 Republican donors over the past dozen years, by the calculations of the New York Times, have given to Jeb Bush than anyone else. So yes, he is the establishment candidate. That's still the way to bet. But there are going to be a lot of turns in this road. They've got to figure out some way to deal with Donald Trump and all of that energy. Scott Walker is a legitimate challenger. Ted Cruz is going to have an appeal to the people who are currently with Donald Trump. There are a lot of other candidates to deal with here and a lot of other forces in the party to deal with, and no one is finally in charge of the Republican Party. There is no one patriarch to go to and say, what should we do?
And there you have it. So there's going to be more debate to come, and everybody looking closely who cares about these issues on Thursday's debate, where Donald Trump will be on the stage. I'd like to thank our listeners and our callers and those who wrote in. Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, thanks for coming in. Dante Scala, political science professor at the University of New Hampshire. You've got a book coming up on the presidential primaries of 2016. Looking forward to that. And Ron Elving, senior correspondent for Washington Affairs. I know I bobbled that a little bit, Ron, at National Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Ron.
Thank you, Fred.
I'd also like to thank many who worked on this show. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Producer is Faith Mikesell. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Fred Bevers, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.